From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, stories from the boxing ring. The new film Million Dollar Baby is based on a story by the late FX Tool, a veteran cut man. We'll listen back to an interview with Tool. For many years, he was the corner man who stops a boxer's bleeding so he can fight another round. Also, the origin of the Serenity Prayer, the prayer adapted by Alcoholics Anonymous. Few people know its origin. It was written by American theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. We'll talk with his daughter, Elizabeth Sifton. And a review of the new film In Good Company, starring Dennis Quaid. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Clint Eastwood's widely acclaimed new movie, Million Dollar Baby, stars Eastwood as an aging veteran of the boxing world who runs a beat-up old gym and is approached by an ambitious young female boxer, played by Hilary Swank, to train her for the ring. Eastwood found the inspiration for his character in the late FX Toole, who spent years in the fight game as a cut man, the guy in a boxer's corner who stops the bleeding between rounds so he can stay in the fight. At the age of 70, Toole published a collection of stories about boxing called Rope Burns. One of them, Million Dollar Baby, is the basis for Eastwood's film. We thought this would be a great time to listen back to Terry Gross's interview with Toole, recorded in 2000. FX Toole learned to box in his late 40s, too late in life to have a career as a fighter. But his years working with other boxers and patching their wounds inspired him to write a trunk full of novels, stories, and plays. He didn't want his boxing friends to know he was writing their stories, so he used the pen name FX Toole. But when his first collection, Rope Burns, was published in 2000, the good reviews blew his cover, and we learned his real name was Jerry Boyd. Toole died 2 years ago at the age of 72 of complications from heart surgery. Let's start with a clip from Million Dollar Baby. Morgan Freeman plays a retired boxer, blind in one eye, who helps run the gym owned by Eastwood's character, Frankie Dunn. Freeman is talking to the young female boxer, played by Hilary Swank. She wants to go up against tougher fighters and is frustrated that Frankie is holding her back. So Morgan Freeman tells her the story of an old fight when Frankie was in his corner as the cut man.
I should have stopped the fight, but hell, I was a black man in San Perdue. Blood was what I was there for. Round after round, I kept getting Frankie to patch me up. He's talking about throwing in the towel, but he ain't my manager. He can't throw in nothing. Round after round, he's arguing with me. I'm almost laughing because hell, it's getting more to him than to me. I go 15 rounds, lose by decision. Next morning, I lose the eye. In 23 years, he's never said a thing about it. Doesn't have to. I can see it in his face every time he looks at me. Somehow, Frankie thinks he should have stopped that fight. Should have saved my eye. Spends his life wishing that he could take back that 109th fight. I wanted to go to 110. Thing is, if you want to get to the title, maybe he's not the one to take you there.
A scene from the new film Million Dollar Baby. Terry spoke with FX Toole in 2000 when his collection Rope Burns was published. He read from the first story in the collection, which is about a cut man.
I stop blood. I stop it between rounds for fighters so they can stay in the fight. Blood ruins some boys. It was that way with Sonny Liston, God rest his soul. Bad as he was, he'd see his own blood and fall apart. I'm not the one who decides when to stop the fight, and I don't stitch up cuts once the fight's over. And it's not my job to hospitalize a boy for brain damage. My job is to stop blood so the fighter can see enough to keep on fighting. I do that, maybe I save a boy's title. I do that one thing, and I'm worth every cent they pay me. I stop the blood and save the fight. The boy loves me more than he loves his daddy. But you can't always stop it. Fight guys know this. If the cut's too deep or wide, or maybe you've got a severed vein down in there, the blood keeps coming. Sometimes it takes two or three rounds to stop the blood, maybe more. The boy's heart is pumping so hard, or he cuts more. Once you get the coagulant in there, sometimes it takes another shot from the opponent right on the cut itself to drive the blood far enough from the area so the stuff you're using can start to work. What I'm saying is there are all kinds of combinations you come up against down in the different layers of meat. When a good cut man stays ahead of the combinations, he can stop most cuts, but not every one.
And that's FX Toole reading from his collection of short stories, Rope Burns. Let's talk a little bit more about what you do as a cut man. What are some of the medicines that you have to stop bleeding?
Well, there's a lot of stuff that's illegal, but most of the time you're using, and I say most of the time, I'm generalizing, but you use adrenaline 1-1000. It's a topical, and it's a vasoconstrictor, not the kind you inject. Then there's thrombin, which is is a coagulant rather than a vasoconstrictor. There's stuff called Atovine. Much of this stuff is used in during surgery.
What's your training like to do this? Do you study medicine at all, or do you just study with another cutter?
You study with other guys. You pick their brains. You have to remember that what you're working on is a restricted area, and the tissue's not very deep. Okay, it's not as if you're trying to work on someone who's suffering a stab wound in the liver. It's shallow tissue. Sometimes it looks like during the fight. Sometimes you think you're looking down into a volcano, but it's you know, that's obviously not the case. So you're working on the face primarily, the forehead, the scalp maybe. And so you learn how to stop that blood. You don't learn how to deal with stab wounds.
Tell me more about what goes on in the corner during the period between rounds. If the fighter is tired and he's bleeding, who's paying attention to him? What's everybody doing? Who's competing for his time there?
Well, there's what you do is you get him breathing deeply from the diaphragm, number one. And you water him down. You put ice packs on him, and you get him breathing. Now, if he's cut, you've got to do all of that and get the blood stopped at the same time. But the fighter is completely focused on you, and he trusts you. He's put his life in your hands, which is one of the reasons I'm so careful about what I do with these kids. And so he's focused on you, and he's learned through the whole training process to listen to you. While the crowd is roaring, he will hear your voice above them all if you shout instructions up to him. But now he's cut, and now he's tired. You get him breathing. You cool him down, and you'll be surprised how someone in good condition, and I'm speaking cardiovascular now, will revive in just that time. Now, if he's terribly hurt, you know, I've called fights off, but that's the last resort. You don't want to do that because, again, his future is in your hands, but you don't want to make a decision to make his future his past either.
As the cut man, it's your job to stop the blood when a boxer's bleeding, when your boxer's bleeding. And I'm wondering how the whole idea of bleeding has changed in the HIV era.
Well, you know, when the HIV really hit and AIDS was rampant and it first hit, got the publicity it did, 10 years or so ago, we were, we were instructed to wear gloves, rubber gloves. The fighters at that time and since have had to take AIDS tests. So at that time it was a much bigger problem than it is today. Now I don't even think they hand out rubber gloves anymore because there are the AIDS test comes along and it's yesterday, you follow, and so they know whether or not these guys are infected. There was a heck of a heavyweight here not too long ago whose test proved positive for AIDS. And here was a big monster of a guy. The odds are he got it using steroids because he was a tall, thin kid at one time. And 2 years later, he's a monster heavyweight.
How would you get AIDS by using steroids?
The needle.
Oh, I see. Got it.
So these guys might be in the gym and say, here, you use the needle, I'll use the needle, you use the needle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
People often are quite foolish in terms of what they do.
Huh. You know the expression, punch drunk, where somebody seems to have lost some of their senses, some of their capacity to think and speak because they've been knocked around too much.
Sure.
Do you see boxers who actually have that condition?
Sure. Yes. I work with one right now. Who talks like that? He talks through a nose, and he walks with a limp, and you have to say, what? What did you say? What? Now, why did that happen? That happened because he was a great young fighter who never got into shape. He tells a great story. He says he prayed before every fight. He said, God, please let me get through this fight, and I promise next fight I'll be in shape. And he said, and I never got in shape. So he fought too long. He got hit too much. One of the reasons he's talking that way is because his nose is broken. It goes off at an angle. But indeed, there's an example. And you know what? He has no regrets whatsoever. He'll joke about the whole show.
In your book, you write, boxing is an unnatural act. Everything in boxing is backwards to life. Instead of running from pain, which is the natural thing in life, in boxing, you step to it. you've boxed as well as worked as a cut man. What's it like to try to get over those natural instincts and replace them with boxing instincts?
Well, I boxed, but you have to understand, my boxing began when I was 48, and I sparred in the gym. I worked out in the gym. I did what we call worked. And I didn't do it as long as I would have, but and you also, if you can imagine, I wear glasses, so when I was sparring, I was throwing punches at shadows, so I probably took more shots than I would have. What happens to you is you become focused on the idea of landing your shots to the other guy, of doing damage to your opponent. And so you take shots, and you have to understand that you're in what's called, you know, Hemingway called hot blood. And so the shots don't hurt you as much while you're excited, because adrenaline is part of the formula. It's later on that fighters, you know, for a day or so afterwards, will be holding their ribs, or they'll, you know, you'll see fighters wearing dark glasses for a couple days, that sort of thing.
I imagine it was a little harder for you to take blows or heal from wounds in your late 40s.
Oh, sure. And I had teeth cracked. I'd had my nose broken before, but I had it broken again. And I would have kept on boxing. I had to quit because I developed a jaw problem, and I was told that I had to wear braces. So you can't box and wear braces. So that's a regret that I have. But nonetheless, a necessary thing for me to have done. Along the way, I found that I was able to do this stuff. I was able to focus. I was able to remember the mechanics. First of all, do the mechanics. The mechanics free your mind. Now, how do you hit this other guy? In a street fight, you can rush up and grab someone by the shirt, by the throat, by the neck, by the head, trip him, knock him down, kick him, and all of that good stuff. But in the ring, it's very hard to hit an opponent who's not going to stand there and fight you back. If he just moves, you're probably not going to be able to do much more than tap him on the shoulder. So, you know, I learned how to do all of this stuff, how to cut off the ring, how to throw punches correctly, how to protect myself. So, you know, it became a way of life for me to the degree that I actually quit writing. I said, why am I ruining my life writing when I can do this other thing? I can participate in it every day instead of being an outsider, instead of being, you know, someone howling in the woods for all those years. And so writing became unimportant to me. And I said, forget it. I'm not gonna hurt like that anymore. And so I know about hurt outside of the ring as well as inside of the ring.
You're talking about the hurt of rejection?
Absolutely. That would destroy me. It would just put me flat on my face.
That hurts more than the broken nose?
Oh, absolutely. No comparison. I'd take a broken nose any old day. To sit there, you know, with that brown envelope in your lap and your head in your hands, and you say to yourself, who am I kidding? I'm no good. If I was any good, somebody would have bought this. I'm just kidding myself. I've wasted my life. I've thrown it away. I thought it was the muse who kissed me, who tapped me on the shoulder, and it was a whore that did. And I've been drained of all my resources. Here I am, a complete fool. Why am I doing this? I've just kidded myself. And I'd go through that, and then slowly I'd get back to my feet. Suddenly another story would play before my eyes, and I'd be back at it again.
FX Tool speaking with Terry Gross in 2000. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2000 interview with the late FX Tool. His boxing story, Million Dollar Baby, is the basis for a new film by Clint Eastwood.
Now, I know as a young man, you studied acting with Sanford Meisner, the famous acting teacher at the Neighborhood Playhouse in New York.
Yes.
You had written plays that weren't produced, but you wrote them. Any connection between boxing and theater?
There's a lot of showbiz in the game, and the audience is there to be entertained. You entertain them differently than say in the theater, and yet the drama is there. It's real drama. It's going on right before their eyes, and all sorts of things are being tested and challenged throughout the course of X number of rounds. And the audience, when they see it and see that it's done well, absolutely becomes enchanted with the activity and are transported.
Of course, in boxing, it's not stage blood, it's real blood.
It's the real deal.
And you like that?
Sure.
Why do you prefer real blood to stage blood?
Well, because it's real. You know, I was a bullfighter, and I was gored 3 times. And so for me to see blood pumping out is not that big a deal. I was gored in the bladder. I was gored in my left leg a couple of times. One of the times there were 3 trajectories that were as long as your hand. And at the time, I weighed probably 140 pounds. I'm 6 foot tall, so you can imagine how thin my leg was. It's part of the territory. It's the price of doing business. It's being there at the time when the greatest challenge is met, and then it's also being there when that challenge is met in a positive or a negative way. And so again, it's real drama. It's not playing. I can go home after the theater or go to the local bar and have a few pops and forget about it. This is stuff that you take for the rest of your life with you for the rest of your life. And that's what I see life as, a series of experiences that should be lived, not nullified, not anesthetized with drugs, etc.
What about street fighting? Were you ever into that? I mean, it's not in an arena, but there's certainly a lot of theatrics and a lot of street fighting and a lot of posturing as well.
Well, I've been in a few street fights. When I was 49 or so, something like that, I was in a street fight and I had part of my right ear bitten off, as a matter of fact. But my opponent was about to go blind, and the only thing that saved him was his girlfriend pulling me off of him. So street fights are nasty and ugly, and the goal is to do maximum damage in the minimum amount of time. So you get your adversary down, and you want to make sure he cannot get up, and if he does get up, he's never going to want to come looking for you again. In boxing, winner loser, they go across the ring and they embrace and say good fight, and the loser says, he was a better man today. If he has talent and ability and one thing and another, that may well be the case. So he'll come back and fight another day. Street fights, you don't ordinarily fight the second or third or fourth or 20th time afterwards.
Who was the first person who read one of your stories and said, "I'm going to publish this"?
It was Howard Junker, God bless him, at a literary magazine out of San Francisco called Zizziva, and Zizziva. And one day I got a phone call, and he introduced himself, and he said, "This is a terrific story. I want to publish it." And I said, "You're kidding." And he said, no, I want to do it. And we chatted a moment, and I think for the first time in my life, I used the word flabbergasted, because I've never used that word before, because I usually have plenty to say, right? But I just could not. I could not believe it. At that moment, I was vindicated, if you will. At that moment, I was a successful writer.
Had you sent him the story?
I had sent him the story through the mail, like I always have. I never put any blurb about myself. I just submit the story, and I was always very selfish about writing. If I was going to have any success in writing or be published at all, I wanted to be absolutely on the merit of the work, as read by someone anonymous, reading an anonymous writer. And that's what happened finally after 40 years.
You're somebody who, in a way, starts things or accomplishes things late in life. You know, you started boxing at the age of 48. You're about 70 now, is that right?
70, yeah.
Yeah, and your first book has just been published. This is something you've wanted your whole life. What's it like to get something that you've always wanted, but get it at the age of 70 when you're not looking ahead at your whole life any longer?
Well, it's sweet indeed. I will also tell you that if this had happened to me at 35, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation, because I was, let's say, something of a wild man. I would probably have destroyed myself along the way, because I'm hoping to make some money on this, but let's assume that I would have made some money. I would have probably squandered it and squandered everything else along with it, because I would have wanted to push the envelope on principle, but also in terms of understanding the world, and if nothing else, to have more things to write about. So it's probably the best thing that could have happened to me individually. I look around and I see so many young people who get success early on, fold in the stretch, if you will, and destroy themselves and destroy a lot of people around them. And what a great tragedy that is, because I think many of them end up with success that they don't feel they've earned. I've earned every bit of it. However much I get, I will have earned it. And I don't say that as some kind of a nut puffing myself up. I'm just saying I paid my dues. Here it is. Thank God it's here. And I'm going to protect it and nurture it to the best of my ability.
Well, FX Tool, Jerry Boyd, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a great delight to be with you.
FX Tool speaking with Terry Gross. He died in 2002. The veteran cutman's boxing story, Million Dollar Baby, is the basis for Clint Eastwood's new film. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, publisher of astrologer Susan Miller's The Year Ahead 2005, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. And from The Dial Press, publisher of Marry After All, a debut novel about a New Jersey housewife's struggle to find herself, by Bill Gordon. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the story behind the Serenity Prayer, adapted by Alcoholics Anonymous and popular around the world. It was written in 1943 by the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. We'll talk with his daughter, Elizabeth Sifton, author of the book The Serenity Prayer. And film critic David Edelstein reviews In Good Company, starring Dennis Quaid. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross. The Serenity Prayer, the prayer adapted by Alcoholics Anonymous, which we'll hear in a moment, is known around the world, but few people know its origins. It was written at the height of World War II by the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, who passionately opposed Hitler. Niebuhr is the author of the books Moral Man and Immoral Society and The Nature and Destiny of Man, texts well known to students of theology. Today we're listening back to an interview with Niebuhr's daughter, Elizabeth Sifton. Her book, The Serenity Prayer, is now out in paperback. It tells the story behind the prayer and discusses her father's view of faith and politics in times of peace and war. Sifton is a senior vice president of the publishing company Farrar, Straus & Giroux. She's worked in publishing for 40 years, but this was her first time out as an author. Terry Gross spoke to her in 2003. Sifton began with the reading of the prayer itself.
God, give us grace to accept with serenity the things that cannot be changed, courage to change the things that should be changed, and the wisdom to distinguish the one from the other.
Elizabeth Sifton, I've always really liked that prayer. I had no idea your father wrote it. I guess most people don't know your father wrote it.
Most people don't know. Many people think other people wrote it, or that it's so old that the origins are lost in the mists of time. He composed it in 1943 for a little village church in northwestern Massachusetts where he spent the summers.
One of the things I've always liked about that prayer is that there are things where I just can't tell if it's something that can be changed or if it's something I must learn to accept. And that gray area between what can be changed and what can't be changed has created considerable anguish in my life over the years.
Well, exactly so. And it does for, I think, all of us or anybody who has any care for the meaning of their lives. That's the condition that's addressed in the third part of the prayer, a prayer for wisdom to distinguish what can be changed from or what should be changed from what cannot be changed. I think my father felt, and he was a social activist and a very deeply committed Christian believer in trying to strive for social justice and improvement in ordinary people's lives, I think he felt that all too often people settled for the status quo thinking it couldn't be changed and did not give real thought to the possibility that it should be. He meant that as a personal thing, as you've mentioned. It's a matter of personal striving, but it's also a matter of social engagement and community care as well. The prayer became famous because shortly after it was written, it was composed, I should say. I don't exactly know how he scribbled it down. Prayers were very often for him simply spoken in a church service. But shortly after he had composed it, a friend of his, and also a person who attended this same small church in Massachusetts in the summer, Dean Howard Robbins of the National Cathedral in Washington, who was a big shot in the Federal Council of Churches, asked if he could use the prayer in a small pamphlet that was being prepared for use in the Army. And so my father said, sure, use it for that. So the first published appearance of the prayer was in a little booklet prepared for servicemen in Europe.
Now, your father wrote the Serenity Prayer during World War II. He was very opposed to Hitler. His father had come to the United States from Germany in the 1800s. How did the war connect to his writing of the Serenity Prayer?
Well, that was the question I asked myself, and I ended up writing a book that's a good bit longer than I expected in order to arrive at the answer. It seems to me that this issue, the issue of what should be, what must be accepted as something that one cannot change and what we must strive to improve or change or alter, and working at developing the wisdom to know the one thing from the other, that this way of looking at things had been sharply honed and developed and shaped during the years of the 1920s and 30s. In the 1920s, my father was a pastor in a working class and middle class congregation in Detroit, a city that was facing enormous social upheavals and difficulties with the development of the auto industries there. And in the 1930s, there was the Great Crash, and there was the rise of fascism and authoritarian and totalitarian regimes in Europe that threatened democracy and freedom everywhere. So the question of whether one opposed these developments and insisted that the drift toward accepting them be changed was a urgent one for him. So I think the formulation brings to a head his consideration of these anguished and difficult problems for more than 20 years.
What really popularized the Serenity Prayer, and I think the reason why so many people know it today, is that it was adopted by Alcoholics Anonymous as a prayer for people who were struggling to overcome their drinking. And I think, you know, other groups have taken it on too, and now it's just become very widely known. How was it adopted by Alcoholics Anonymous?
I don't have the documentary paper trail on this. I only know, my father told me this, my mother repeated it, that at some point, I think in the late 40s, after the war, they simply wrote and asked him if they could use it, and he said, sure. Similarly, Hallmark cards had also asked him if they could use it, and he had said, sure. The fact that they simplified it, omitting the grace, for example, from the first sentence.
When you say they, are you talking about AA?
AA, excuse me. I don't know whether they did that deliberately or it just happened. Prayers, after all, get spoken even more perhaps than they get read. And as they're passed around, they may just get a bit streamlined. But in any case, the AA version, which simply says, not give us, but give me serenity to accept the things that cannot be changed, et cetera, et cetera. They may have just done that in the course of things, not with a deliberate intention to alter it in any way.
It shocks me to hear that your father was willing to allow Hallmark to use the prayer for greeting cards. I mean, that's in some ways, with no offense to Hallmark, but in some ways, everybody's worst fear is that like a wonderful piece of poetry or a profound literary statement will be used as like a little bumper sticker or a greeting card or something. And even though the words are the same, somehow it will be trivialized in that context.
I think he felt that, yes, it might be, and probably would be, but that it was not for him to determine that it should be controlled and kept pure highbrow in some way. Mm-hmm. He didn't think of prayers like that. Prayers were written and composed and spoken from the heart for everyone, and one didn't control their use. Who was he to say how people would find it meaningful for them? So I think he just let it happen. That's very much part of his general ecumenical view that grace and serenity and courage and wisdom come to everyone in all walks of life in different parts of the world at different times. And it is not for him to say who should or should not use this prayer. He never, ever would have thought of copywriting it or asking for royalties on it, which often people jokingly say to me he should have done. It's an all-American thing, I suppose, to want to make money from anything one has done that has been in the least bit successful, but that would have appalled him.
So Hallmark never paid him for the use of the Serenity Prayer?
Not that I know of. They might have paid him a fee just at the beginning, but I don't know. That was in the 40s when I was a baby, and I don't actually know, and I have no record of it.
What are some of the most unusual or interesting contexts you've seen the Serenity Prayer used in or reprinted in?
Well, there are many kitschy versions. It's funny to find it on book plates or on coffee mugs. Well, of course, that's inevitable for, in this day and age. I have a T-shirt with it on. But the most interesting, you asked, the most interesting I know about is not one that I've actually personally seen. But my friend Joseph Lelieveld, when he was correspondent for the New York Times in South Africa, saw the prayer quite often on a plaque hanging on a kitchen or living room wall in many black townships in Soweto and so on. And that moved me greatly to think, and it would have pleased my father to know that this prayer was of use to the black communities of South Africa in the terrible years of apartheid. But Joe also pointed out to me that he saw the prayer also on the walls of white supremacist apartheid supporters in South Africa, which suggests that whatever side you're on, you feel that it's appropriate for you.
Elizabeth Sifton speaking with Terry Gross in 2003. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2003 interview with Elizabeth Sifton. Her book, The Serenity Prayer, focuses on the well-known prayer by her father, Reinhold Niebuhr.
You write about how one of the things that your father and many of his friends tried to puzzle through was where religion should fit in the public life of a country that was founded on the principle of separation of church and state. What were some of the ideas that your father had on that subject?
My father felt very strongly that the separation of church and state was an important and principle that must be attended to. More than saying what he thought the government should do about this, he was concerned with the health of the churches and the way the churches would approach this matter. He felt all too often that Protestant and Catholic and other clerics were hungry themselves for power and influence, and therefore compromised their distance from the powers that be by sucking up to them, by enjoying access to privilege and governmental power when they should keep their distance from it.
And it sounds like he also thought that the church should often challenge that power.
That's right. He felt that it was a part of the great Christian tradition to derive their understanding of the church's role in modern society the way the prophets in the Old Testament spoke of it, that there must be a distance kept from the temptations and evils of secular society, because secularism is evil. I mean the dangers of partisan selfish and over-commercialized activities. The church should stay clear of these and not succumb to them. He also was very skeptical of ministers who became famous for their close association with political figures. He would say of them that they were always trembling on the abyss of exhibitionism. Exhibitionism is what many secular and agnostic and atheist people think that ministers first and foremost are, and I can't blame them.
Your father was critical in his time of both the left and the right. Can you describe what his criticisms of each were?
His criticism of the left, where he belonged himself, really, because he was a social progressive and cared tremendously for the issues of social justice and the betterment of all lives in any community, which I believe is a left position. His criticism of the left in the 20s and 30s and even into the 40s and 50s and 60s was that they tended to be cheerfully and rather stupidly optimistic about the chances for improvement and betterment, that they adopted what he called simplistic enlightenment ideas about progress of mankind, if only people are rational and good to each other and so on. And he thought the record of human history shows that this is absolutely not realistic, that there must be a deeper and better understanding of what makes people act the way they do, and why there is so much evil and harm in the world must be interpreted in a more demanding and complicated way than many liberals did, who would just preach, I say preach even if they weren't ministers, preach self-improvement and betterment if only people were smarter or nicer or more rational or more sensible, or if only this would happen or that would happen. The most hubristic, simplistic attitude on the left that he deplored was, of course, the communist one. He was vehemently anti-communist on very Christian grounds. He thought it was a godless and hubristic idea to think that it was within the power of human beings to reorganize their society in such a way as to make everything come out right in the end, which the communists assured their followers their regimes could do. So that was his criticism of the left.
What about his criticism of the right?
His criticism of the right was deeper and more complete and more constant, because the right was so much in power and at the helm. even during the New Deal, which challenged the right-wing orthodoxies of American economic life. He felt that wealthy and powerful people who control the levers of power and economic ownership of the means of production, to use the Marxist phrases, that these people had absolutely no regard, or very little regard, or insufficient regard for the welfare of everyone, and particularly of workers and of the less fortunate than they. That in a very big, dynamic, competitive, capitalist society like America, there was not any attention being paid on the right to the ordinary issues of social justice and economic fairness. He wrote somewhere that rich princes always imagine that they are wise. They imagine that they think they're wise because they're powerful and at the top of the heap, and it never occurs to them that they're only there because they have all the money, not because they are wiser than anyone else. So he inveighed constantly against the powers that be that he felt were unjust and indifferent to suffering.
Your parents had an interfaith marriage. I mean, it wasn't totally interfaith, but it was mild on the scale of what interfaith means.
But yes.
But your mother was Episcopalian, and your father's church was?
The Evangelical and Reformed Church, which was a small denomination founded by Germans in the 19th century and eventually merged with the Congregationalists, and they're now called the United Church of Christ.
Did your parents have disagreements about faith or about worship?
Not about faith, I think, but certainly about worship. They had quite strong disagreements about worship. My mother, as an Anglican, she was English and had been raised in the Anglican communion in England, was very liturgical. She believed in the great liturgy laid down in the Book of Common Prayer. My father was an evangelical. He believed that prayer and worship must come, as it were, spontaneous. You must open up your heart and spirit, and as the Spirit moves you, you pray. However, he greatly admired the liturgical communions, as he called it, the liturgical churches, for establishing a kind of discipline over these prayers, because he thought that it was important for ministers and the congregation to understand that prayers couldn't be and worship couldn't be a time for personal blandishments and show-off times, and that it was important to adhere to some sort of discipline of worship that the regular liturgies provided. However, in given instances, my father and my mother would argue about these things.
You are the vice president of Farrar, Straus, Giroux, the publishing house, and you've been in publishing your whole adult life. This is the first book you've written, and I guess I'm wondering why it's taken you so long to write a book.
Oh, because I didn't have time to write a book. Helping others get their books published was more than enough work for me. And I also didn't have a subject that I wanted to write about. When I was in college, I studied both history and literature. I never focused on one historical or political issue or type of work, nor did I with literary work. And it's been a joy for me as a publisher to work in both fields. And I'm a generalist. I never had a particular subject I wanted to write about. But then, wishing to clarify the history of this beautiful prayer and its enormous popularity gave me my subject. So I wrote it then. It's an amazing thing to write a book after you've helped so many other people see a book being published. It's very different from the other side of the desk, I'll tell you.
What are some of the differences?
Well, here's a very simple one. If a writer gives me, as an editor, a manuscript to look at, and I say I'll get to it right away, I mean that I'll get to it within the week, right? Or as soon as I can, and there are 55 million other things I've got to do. Of course, I know that every writer wants to be thought of as the editor's sole responsibility for the moment, but I always tried to say, listen, I'm not sure I can read that till next Tuesday, you know, and then the writer would say, oh yes, I understand that. Well, as a writer, I cannot understand why people don't call me within 20 minutes of reading my book. the 24 hours maximum. That's one example. The writing and editing of it was not so different in a way. The late Laurie Colwin, who was a friend and colleague of mine, said once when asked the same question about writing and editing and the differences, she said that she always looked at other people's prose as if it were her own and addressed the editorial problems with care as if they were her own. But she tried to read her own prose as if it was somebody else's, ruthlessly, you know? And I tried to do the same.
Elizabeth Sifton, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Elizabeth Sifton speaking with Terry Gross. Her book, The Serenity Prayer, is now out in paperback. Coming up, David Edelstein on the new film, In Good Company. This is Fresh Air. The director Paul Weitz made his name, along with his brother Chris, as the writer and director of the gross-out, scatological sex romp American Pie. But the Weitz brothers' next film was the more grown-up About a Boy, based on the novel by Nick Hornby. Paul Weitz's newest film, which he wrote and directed himself, is In Good Company, starring Dennis Quaid, Topher Grace, and Scarlett Johansson. David Edelstein has a review.
Salesmen carry a lot of freight in plays and movies about our economic unease. And why shouldn't they? They're at the axis of our capitalist way of life. They're the middlemen between fickle corporate Goliaths and fickle consumers. Paul Weitz's In Good Company is a liberal humanist sitcom set in a brutal global capitalist universe. The movie doesn't cut very deep, and it's impossibly sweetened, so that most of the characters get their just desserts. But it's also funny and charming, and it manages to get at lots of disturbing things about the way we live now. Our deepest fears about our place in a system that could make us clean out our offices at the drop of a stock point. Dennis Quaid plays Dan Foreman, the old-fashioned 50-ish head of ad sales at a sports magazine clearly modeled on Sports Illustrated. In the first scene, he simply hands a copy of his magazine to a reluctant advertiser and walks away, shocking the CEO by saying its quality will speak for itself. Now, I don't know that Dan could make it these days at a place like Time Warner. In Good Company has a whiff of the early 80s, when the old guard watched in horror as the first wave of MBA barbarians stormed the gate. But this terror is timeless. Young men who bring a macho triumphalism to laying people off, who refer to one another as chainsaw maniacs and ninja assassins. The assassins of In Good Company are sent by a multinational mogul called Teddy Kaye, who's played by the reliably satanic Malcolm McDowell. His agents demote Dan, and to take his place appoint Carter Duryea, played by Topher Grace, a 26-year-old with no sales experience but one marketing coup, dinosaur-shaped cell phones for 5-year-olds. Carter has a mandate to cut jobs and raise revenue, as he explains to the older man while force-feeding him sushi.
Dan! I'm not letting you go here.
You're not?
No. You were an excellent salesman. You ran a good team. I think that you have the potential to be an awesome wingman here.
An awesome wingman? But Carter, I definitely see the benefit for you in having an awesome wingman, but what is the benefit for me at this point in my career of being an awesome wingman?
Well, one benefit at this point in your career is that you get to keep your job. It's a pretty good benefit, don't you think?
Carter isn't vacuous, but he's a punk, a tool. He hasn't thought through the meaning of Teddy Kaye's corporate mantra, synergy, which is the movie's boogeyman word. Synergy is used like melanoma. It's anti-human. It spreads. It squeezes out the good guys with a malignant monopoly. Quaid's Dan is the stubborn voice of humanism, while Grace's Carter stands for all that is amoral and rapacious and... Well, hold on. He isn't much of an antagonist, actually. Grace cut his teeth on That 70s Show, and he's a puppy-eyed young actor with an appealing self-consciousness. He dithers adorably. He could be Robert Downey Jr.'s kid brother, Downey without the danger, with a soft center. In Good Company is supposed to be about Carter's conversion from corporate machine to man, but there's no real drama or suspense because the script has him lovably confessing his insecurities right off the bat. The twist is that Carter confesses them to Dan's college sophomore daughter, played by Scarlett Johansson. So Dan is losing both his little girl and his place in the world to this whippersnapper. And Quaid plays the patriarchal anxiety and rage with just enough style to keep it funny and just enough realism to keep it poignant. Carter doesn't sneer at Dan and say, "I've had your daughter." He's abashed. He's sheepish. He's genuinely smitten with the young woman. That's the sweetened part of In Good Company, that both men are protagonists, nice guys wanting the same good things. So the movie has a soft center, too, and director Weitz lets it run down. He makes mistakes in the pacing, but they're the mistakes of a director who likes his characters and his actors too much. In how smoothly it goes down, In Good Company is very much a corporate Hollywood product. But there's an honorable place for a writer-director who can work within a system and criticize it, who can remind you of arbitrary economic injustice in the context of a romantic fairy tale. I'd say that's some honest synergy.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdy. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Harcourt, publisher of The Facts Behind the Helsinki Rockamadios, a collection of short stories by Jan Martel, author of Life of Pi. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Lifetime Achievement Awards at this year's Grammys will go to the Staples Singers and Jelly Roll Morton. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from Mavis Staples and Vernell Bonarice, who performs the music of Jelly Roll Morton. Join us for the next Fresh Air.